On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was young men, big money, high risk, and do-or-die lightning-speed action, and we're not talking hedge fund traders here. When America was young and the Earth's seas were teeming, the big, juicy score, the fast money, was in whaling. Adventurous risk-takers with their eyes on the golden prize set out as captains on the high seas with full sail and harpoon and crews making peanuts. They brought home the great whales and casks of ambergris and oil that made the nation's first fortunes. Today we say save the whales, then they said boil them. Up next on Point, when whalers ruled the earth. Joining me now in the studio is Eric J. Dolan, author of the new book Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America. It's an astonishing account of what our forebears saw as the golden age of American whaling and much more. Eric J. Dolan, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Here you are writing every little amazing detail about this business in a time when touching a whale is, as we said, the great taboo. How did it feel writing about the hunting and killing of, I don't know, maybe millions of whales in the end? Now it's the thing to do.
Right. Well, it wasn't that difficult because I put it in its historical perspective. I chose not to judge the whalemen by today's cultural, ethical, and moral sensitivities. Instead, I wanted to look at them for what they were at the time in their own context. And you have to remember, back when American whaling was in its heyday, whales were looked at as floating profit centers. They were not looked at animals that deserved to be protected for their own inherent rights.
There's so much we're going to learn here about the culture and the economy and the attitudes and, for that matter, the literature around whaling. But take us straight away, if you would. And I know there were many eras of whaling, but take us right out when it's on the high seas. Mm-hmm. You're chasing a big whale, maybe a sperm whale. You're off the mothership. You're out in the little boat. Exactly how did those American whalers go about killing a giant whale?
Well, they would row towards the whale as fast as they could. Often the two or more whale boats would be in a race, with the honors going to that which got to the whale first.
And this is after we heard the thar she blows, right, or there she breaches off the guy, the lookout up in the mast. So
right,
off they go in pursuit.
Yep. Yep, they jump down in their whale boats. Off they go in pursuit. And when they get what is
called... How big is this whale boat, sorry?
Oh, the whale boat is about 26 feet. There are six men in it, and they're pulling their oars as hard as they can.
Big, heavy, sturdy boat or something light?
No, it's about a half-inch clapboard cedar between you and the ocean depths.
Oh, okay.
So it's something that a whale could easily destroy when they chose to do so, and they chose to do so many times.
How far might the whale be from the mothership here when it's
caught? Oh, it could be up to 8 miles out that they see the first spout, or it could be right off the bow.
And if it's, how far would they row in this race typically to get to the...
Well, there's no average, but they could go many miles. Sometimes it took the better part of a day
to row
this
out
chase.
To
row and chase, harpoon the whale, and then the whale would pull the whale boat on a proverbial Nantucket sleigh ride.
Well, but before that, we've got to get something stuck into it. Now, we've got a half dozen men in a 20-something foot.
26-foot boat.
Half-inch plank
cedar
here.
Clapboard.
Cedar clapboard here. So it's a skiff on the high seas.
Yes.
The chase is on. One of them gets there. They're now somewhere near the whale. What happens to get to a kill?
Well, when they get near the whale, they get very quiet because they don't want to startle the whale. And the boat steer, once the boat is wood to blackskin, as they say, so it's right on top of the whale, because you couldn't launch a harpoon more than about 15 or 20 feet because the purpose is to drive it deep into the whale's flank. So once
hold us right there at boat to blackskin. How do you get boat to blackskin? Is the whale on the surface and you just paddle up to it, or are you having to guess where it's going to surface for its next breath of air?
Both. It depends when you come upon it. And what they're doing is they're tracking the whale. And when it's on the surface, they know exactly where it is. But then they had little rules of thumb for when the whale went down. There would be a certain amount of time before it would come up, and they would check its trajectory. They'd know which direction the whale was going in. And then they'd try to appear or be where the whale was next going to come up.
Now, let's say it's a good-sized bull male sperm whale.
Right.
How long is it going to stay at the surface once it comes up?
Oh, it could be just a part of a minute or maybe longer, depending on what they're doing. And then they can go down for upwards of an hour, depending on what kind of dive they're doing. But hopefully it would be relatively quickly that they'd come back up.
And the surface is everything here, because that's the only time they can reach that whale. If it's
right,
a good-sized bull sperm whale in the heyday of whaling, how big might it be?
it could be about 60 feet long and 50 tons. This is a massive creature.
50 tons. All right.
Yes.
Now, here's this massive creature. Miraculously, we've rowed out to it. We're right on top of it. Boat to black skin, as you say.
Right. Wood to black skin.
Wood to black skin. Yes. And somebody's got a harpoon. How are we arrayed in the boat at this point?
Well, the boat steerer stands up, puts his leg, braces his leg in the clumsy cleat, which is a cut out of the side of the boat, arches back, and thrusts the harpoon into the flank of the whale as deep as he can. And if he has the time, he'll throw a second harpoon into the whale. But at this point, the whale is going to start taking off at a rapid clip.
Now, how big are these harpoons?
Oh, they can be 8 or 9 feet long. They are steel shank. They have a steel, a double flued head or a single flued head, or sometimes
they have.
So
if it goes in, it's not coming out easily. How deep do they try and get that harpoon on the
first? Oh, all the way up to the wood pole that is attached to the iron shank. It can be a couple of feet in.
But this first one is just to get attached to the whale, not obviously to kill it.
No, harpoons rarely, if ever, kill the whale. It is simply a means of attaching the whaleboat and the men to the whale.
Now, the 50-ton whale is then attached, shall we say,
yes,
by the
attached
harpoon.
And very upset.
It takes off,
yes.
And there's some screaming rope action here. What
right. Well, the harpoon is attached to a line that can be up to 600 fathoms long, and that goes whizzing out around the loggerhead, and they have to pour water on top of it to keep it from scorching and possibly igniting. And also the boat is all of a sudden taken on the proverbial Nantucket sleigh ride, which is this...
Over the seas we go.
Over the seas we go at very fast. And the boat steer at this moment has a hatchet at the ready, because should that whale decide to sound, that boat could be pulled under in an instant, so he would cut the line if he was quick enough. Or if the boat went along the surface at too great a distance, it might pull the boat out of sight of the mother ship, and that was something they also wanted to avoid.
And gone forever, potentially.
Right.
Who knows if they're over the horizon where they are?
Absolutely. There were no GPS devices back then.
I guess not. How long does the sleigh ride last then?
Oh, it could last for literally hours. There are stories of angry sperm whale bulls that have pulled not only one whale boat, but many whale boats that have been attached to it for many, many hours at a time. It depends on how much strength the whale has and what it chooses to do. But eventually, these boats that are attached to the harpoon line act as a drag, and the whale
tires.
They're
tiring the whale and tiring it.
Yep.
And the more tired it gets, they're attaching more stuff to it, correctly, to slow it down, make it harder for it to swim.
Right. If they can get back up to the whale, they'll harpoon it again, or another boat may come along. But eventually, the whale will slow down, and they'll be in a position to pull up once again wood to black skin. And now a very different instrument comes out. And at this point, the boat steerer and the boat header, the mate, the officer in the boat, will have switched positions.
We're heading for the coup de grace here.
It gets
pretty gory.
Yes.
Where are they aiming? What are they using? What's the goal?
Well, the goal is to kill the whale as quickly as possible. And what they do is they take a lance, which is a very long pole with a steel knife, essentially, at the end, and they thrust it into the whale looking for the life of the whale, which is right around the lungs or a knot of blood vessels. And success shows itself.
Front on a sperm whale or mid-whale?
Mid-whale on the side.
Near
the
blowhole?
Behind the blowhole.
Behind the blowhole, but they're coming through the side here.
Yes, at the side or down to the top. I mean, it depends on what the position of the whale is. And it's very tricky because at this point, the whale is still angry, and certainly when you're lancing it,
plenty strong,
it can easily destroy the whaleboat with a single flick of its fluke.
So they try and push that in so deep it gets to what you call the life, the sort of vital organs, and they grind and grind that thing.
Right, they turn and success shows itself as a gusher of blood out of the blowhole, which the whaleman called a fire in the chimney or tapping the claret. And then it's probably the most dangerous time of the whale hunt, or one of the most dangerous times, because the whale goes into its final flurry and it starts swimming around in tighter and tighter circles. And this is a time often when sperm whales in particular might chomp a whaleboat in two with its mighty tooth-studded jaw, or smash it with its flukes, which were referred to by the whalemen as the hands of God, because when they came down on your boat, you were going to meet your maker.
All right, Eric J. Dolan, we've got Greenpeace members, leaping out of their boats all over the country at this point. How often did this happen in the American Age of Whaling? How many times was this repeated?
In 1853, which is the height of the Golden Age, the American whaling fleet, which is the largest in the world, killed a little bit more than 8,000 whales of a variety of species.
8,000 times in a single year.
But keep that in perspective. During the 20th century, well after the Yankee whaleman was history, mm-hmm. the factory whale ships of other countries such as Russia, Japan, England, could kill in a single year as many whales as the Yankee whaleman at the height of the Golden Age killed in the better part of a decade. So it's still a dead whale, but it was a difference in kind and scope, later whaling activities.
You didn't take your focus onto that age of factory ship whaling. You stuck with the age of sail, the sort of what you call right. the Golden Age. Why?
Right. Well, mainly because that's where America's history in this was made. If you were to write a book about America's perspective or involvement in whaling during the latter half of the 20th century, it would be more of a political book about international diplomacy, the International Whaling Commission. I wanted to look purely at the history of American whaling when it was an industry that was a going concern.
Eric J. Dolan joins me in the studio. His book has been very well received. It really is quite a compendium of, amazing detail and adventure. Not exactly the tastes of contemporary environmentalists by any means, but then, as he says, it was a different time and a different economy. Eric, I think when a lot of people look at whaling, they see something obscure and antique and distasteful. Mm-hmm. But you make some really big claims for it right at the get-go in your book. You say it didn't just go on. You say whaling was a powerful force in the evolution of the country. You say much of America's culture, economy, and in fact its spirit were literally and figuratively rendered from the bodies of whales. Justify those big claims.
Well, I'm not sure we have enough time to justify them completely, but part of it has to do with how important whaling was during the era of whaling. And one of the things that fascinated me most is how important whaling was even before the American Revolution. Right before the American Revolution broke out, there were 360 whale ships leaving from colonial ports. 150 of those alone came from Nantucket, whose entire economy was built on the back of whaling. This was a large industry. Over 50% of the income that New England received from the mother country came from the sale of whale oil and baleen. Even in Massachusetts, where cod was said to be king, whaling had a greater impact on the local economy. Whalemen, American whalemen, were known worldwide. The whaling fortunes that were generated and the income generated as it went throughout the economy certainly played a role in helping us to break free of the shackles of England during the American Revolution, and helped form many of the people that fought in our nascent Navy then and later in the War of 1812. And then you fast forward about 50 or 70 years during the Golden Age, and in the middle of the century, the middle of the 1800s, whaling was the third largest industry in Massachusetts after shoes and cotton. It was the fifth largest industry in the United States.
In the whole country.
In the whole country. It was considered a source of national pride. In
And this is moving toward the Civil War period. We're talking pilgrims and scratching anything they can. This is when we've got an economy.
Right. But you mentioned the pilgrims. Even way back then, they were taking advantage of drift whales. So there's this theme. Whaling sort of creates a way to look at a narrative of American history. It's really, I used it as a backbone to look at American history. And it had a huge economic impact. Certainly Moby Dick. Now, one book can have a large impact. And Moby Dick is sort of like our nation's single book club selection. Mm. And much of that is filtered through our culture. And when you look at New England in particular, San Francisco and Hawaii, a lot of what helped to make them great places and to build them up from the very earliest times can be attributed to whaling. And even though we don't go whaling today and haven't for many, many years, I still think it's a strong theme.
And this cultural stamp then, is American culture what took Americans whaling, or did whaling imprint some cultural profile on the American cultural character?
Well, it's hard, not a cultural historian, it's sort of hard to say which affected which, but what happened is when they came to America and started whaling, it helped to create the country that we now live in. And
the American spirit, you
the
say.
The American spirit. Well, I think a lot of the American
spirit. Rendered from the body of whales.
The American spirit, a lot of the people that chose to come over here in the early years had an entrepreneurial spirit, even though it wouldn't have been called that at the time. And they were sort of expectant capitalists. And when they landed on this concept of whaling as a lifeline to their future prosperity, they took it to the nth degree. And American whalemen became the greatest, I think, nation of whalemen ever to sail the seas.
Do you equate the great age of whaling to the great era of the slaughter of the buffalo, or do you see those as different? The two great beasts ultimately driven near extinction, right. But do you equate those two?
Well, you can, because both were extractive industries that were taking advantage of a natural resource, whales or buffalo. And certainly American whalemen drove a couple of species near to extinction. And buffalo, we went down to 200 towards the end of the 1800s. And the bison robes and the buffalo tongues also helped to create great fortunes. They're not exactly parallel, but keep in mind, what I didn't want to pass judgment on what American whalemen did using today's cultural sensitivities, our ethical perspective.
Our environmental awareness.
They saw
these just as fish, big fish.
Absolutely, and many of them did believe they were fish for many, many years. I mean, I consider myself to be a very strong environmentalist, and my views on modern whaling are nowhere in this book, and I didn't try to allow them to color what I thought about the history. I wanted to present the history in its proper context and let readers decide how they want to digest that.
I should say, and it's interesting, you were a former policy analyst for the National Marine Fisheries Service. You've worked to set limits and manage regulations for different kinds of fish that might be caught and captured.
Sure, and I worked for EPA for 6 years on global climate change, and my undergraduate, my master's, and my PhD are all in environmental policy. I don't find any disconnect between my strong environmental leanings and the great fun, and I will emphasize that fun I had in writing this book and learning about all the ways in which whaling has sent currents through American history. I think it's very important to understand our history and not try to change it because you may not like in the present state what we did many years ago.
The harpoons are bristling in Eric J. Dolan's new book, Leviathan. So are the phone lines. Let's go to them. Timothy's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. There's a great fishing town. What do you say, Timothy?
Good day. Thank you for taking my call. My father was a crewman on a sailing whaling vessel out of Boston in the early 20s, and a couple of stories he would recount to me. I was wondering whether your author came across some information with respect to the operation of the whale boat itself. My father would mention that on occasion they would have three rows on one side, two on another, and that the helmsman of the longboat was essentially the lancer, and then the harpooner was in the bow. The harpooner would throw the harpoon and then run like hell to the back of the end of the to the stern of the boat, and the helmsman would run up to the front because he was the lancer. And I was wondering whether your author came across that kind of procedure on occasion in these whale boats.
Timothy, we'll get to that absolutely, but let me ask you, you said 1920s your father was still doing this, so he was right at the very tail end of this in American terms.
Out of Boston, it was the Ellen A. Swift. It was a sailing vessel, and their grounds were essentially the Bermuda area.
Yeah. Amazing. Eric J. Dolan.
He's absolutely correct. The caller is correct. They engaged in this rather odd dance where the boat steer, the man at the front of the boat, would actually harpoon the boat, but the man
harpoon
at the back,
the whale.
Harpoon the whale. The man at the back, called the boat header, who was of a higher rank, usually a mate on the whale ship, they would exchange places. So it was the boat header, the mate, that would have the honor, so to speak, of lancing the whale and giving its final coup de grace. And as to why this elaborate dance, when they're going over the waves at a rapid pace and have to maneuver past each other in a not necessarily very stable whale boat, it's not clear. One reason is perhaps that it was to give the honor of lancing the whale to the highest ranking individual, or alternatively, he was the most skilled in performing that art. Flinging the harpoon or thrusting the harpoon into the side of the whale perhaps was not considered as high of a degree of skill.
Timothy, your father must have been a very young man. How did he speak of that whaling that he was part of?
Well, some of the adventures you really can't say on the radio. But
high times in Bermuda.
There was a certain amount of competition about natural functions that would go on deck. But the other couple of things that might be of interest, perhaps your author could expand on it, was that in addition to the odd dance that would go on in the whale boat, that often they would have their sails, because these boats carried single-lug sails, right, and they would sail in their chase for the whales. And then when they were getting near the whales, this was not a simple, was not a very careful procedure, according to my father. They'd rip up the mast and fling it in the middle of the boat while all these oars and lines are there, and then row up.
In order to begin rowing.
There you go. And
Must have been mayhem on those boats.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, many of the men that manned these boats were what were called green hands. This may have been their first time on the ocean. Many whalemen didn't even know how to swim, so if they were knocked out of their boat and didn't find something to hold on to, they might have drowned. So not only was there this difficult and strange dance that took place, but many of the men in the boat were absolutely scared to death as they were coming up on this enormous whale, which they knew by experience could kill a man and kill many men.
Bring down the hand of God. Timothy, thank you for linking us back just one generation back to all the history that Eric J. Dolan brings us. Thanks for your call. Let's take one from Hampton, Virginia. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Nice talking to you. I am living in a fishing community here. Hampton, Virginia is a large fishing community on the Chesapeake Bay.
Great.
I'm very interested in what your author is talking about. I am planning to take a trip to North Dakota next week, and I'll try to procure his book to take with me.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out that I noticed in the news about in the local newspaper about a month ago that a whale had been located somewhere, and it had a harpoon point embedded in the body, and it was this harpoon point they determined was probably, could only have been made in New Bedford about 1850 or something like that. Does your author know anything about that?
A harpoon point found embedded in a whale that would have been more than a century old. Is that possible?
Oh, yes. What the caller is referring to is back last May, there was a bowhead hunt up off Alaska, and one of the whales that was killed
when they were cut by Inuit?
Inuits, the native exception. Mm-hmm. And when they were cutting into it, they found an unexploded head of a harpoon gun or grenade, and that bowhead whale was very lucky that for some reason this didn't explode, which was designed to give a mortal blow. And by taking that to the experts at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, they were able to determine that that harpoon was probably made in the latter part of the 1800s and probably shot into this whale. I think it was sometime between 1885 and 1895. So this whale was well over 100 years old. And this is a great discovery for many mammalogists who are still working on figuring out how long these mighty leviathans can live. And it gave us an interesting glimpse into America's whaling past, because that bowhead was part of a population that was nearly driven to extinction. So he was lucky not only to survive this long, but also to survive and not have that harpoon head explode in his side.
It's absolutely amazing. You've got a great passage on sperm whales, which I wish you'd read for us, Eric J. Dolan. I mean, these were the biggest of the big, perhaps the most mysterious.
Okay. Moby Dick had to be a sperm whale, not just because the sperm whale is the only type of whale known to have sunk ships deliberately, a critical element to be sure, but because it is the only whale whose biography was fantastic enough to sustain the grand and sweeping novel that bears his name. From virtually every perspective, the sperm whale is an astounding animal. Its size, its shape, its behavior, its physiology, its mighty tooth-studded jaw, its powerful tail, its grace and beauty are all wonders to behold. And in death, this hulking leviathan provided the whaling industry both with its most unusual products and some of its greatest profits. The sperm whale, more than any other whale, has captured the public's imagination to the point that when the average person envisions a whale, it is the sperm whale that they most often see. Whether this is a relic of Moby Dick's great fame or the result of the inherent power that sperm whales certainly possess is open to debate. But whatever the reason, the sperm whale clearly is the whale's whale. The sperm whale specializes in extremes, earning it a string of superlatives. It is the biggest of the odontocetes, or toothed whales, a group that includes pilot whales, killer whales, and a wide range of dolphins. The largest male or bull sperm whales reach lengths of just over 60 feet and weigh as much as 50 tons. No whales exhibit greater disparities between the sexes than do sperm whales, with the females, or cows, being much smaller than their male counterparts, growing to 40 feet in length and 18 tons in weight. Sperm whales have the largest skull of any whale, the largest head of any animal, and the largest brain of any species, which can tip the scales at 20 pounds. They dive deeper than any other whale, regularly descending many thousands of feet, at times well over a mile, and they can stay under the water for upward of an hour. The sperm whale's skin, which can reach a depth of 14 inches, is the thickest of any animal, and its tail is, in proportion to its body, the largest of all the whales, and arguably the most stunning. In no living thing, opined Melville, are the lines of beauty more exquisitely defined than in the crescentic borders of these flukes.
Eric J. Dolan reading from his new book, Leviathan, on the amazing sperm whale. Let's go to Jason in Alston, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Dolan. That was really awesome. And I actually have a question about your book. I started it on audio, and I haven't finished it yet. But Moby Dick was my introduction to this part of American history. And I just wanted to ask you, Moby Dick has had such a profound impact on our culture. And I guess I wanted to know, is it difficult to look at this period of American history without viewing it through the lens of Moby Dick? And, as you were writing this book, did you feel Melville's ghost over your shoulder?
It's a great question, Jason. Our time is short before the break. What about it? Herman Melville leaning over your shoulder as you wrote?
I have to tell you, I gave a talk recently in the book, and when Herman Melville's picture came up on the screen, I announced proudly to the audience that this was Moby Dick. So, yes, he has been in my nightmares a little bit, but it didn't make it difficult to write the book because I read Moby Dick in high school, and it certainly informed a lot of my knowledge about whaling, but there was so much more about the history of whaling that either wasn't in Moby Dick, or if it was, could be presented in a different way, that I found Moby Dick and Herman Melville a nice adjunct or associate in writing the book. I didn't find him a foe or an obstacle.
Did you feel like a fact checker of Melville? Were you exposing, what he had that was fact and what was fancy in his depiction?
No, he had a lot of things right. He had some things gravely wrong, such as that whales were fish or that human avarice could never lead to the near extinction of any of these species. But overall, it's a wild book, a great book, and certainly a book that was not accepted in its time. I was fascinated to learn that when he died in near obscurity, Harper's Weekly gave him a single sentence obituary. And he thought Moby Dick was going to launch him to the heights of success, literary success, but instead it started him on a slide towards obscurity.
Here's Gregory Peck in the role of Captain Ahab from the 1956 classic John Huston version of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, as the captain guides his crew and gives voice to his obsession for one whale above all others.
Oh, did you see him, man? You see his hump like a great snow hill. You see the way he slides along? Oh, there's majesty for you. Don't look. I'll look for you. Did you see the lances in his back? My lances. Mine. Stricken him years ago.
My lances, and you can hear the oars there in the oarlocks as they head off to sea after, well, you know who. Peggy's calling from Woodford, Rhode Island. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. How are you?
Very well.
I was calling because years ago we went to the New Bedford Museum, and they had a film. And my understanding is that it was part of a Hollywood film about whaling, but they had actually gone out with whalers and videoed, well, they didn't call it video then,
yeah,
but
filmed.
They'd actually gone out and followed the hunt and the harpooning of the whale and the boat being pulled. And
it was the real thing, not a recreation.
That's my understanding, mm-hmm. And I don't know if they still show that at the New Bedford Museum. And on one hand, it was astounding. On another hand, it was horrifying.
Describe each of those responses. What leads you to each of those adjectives, Peggy?
Well, what those men put themselves, in the face of this and the uncertainty of it and, the sort of the violence of it, and never knowing what the whale was going to do, and they were really sort of powerless until the whale got tired, it seemed.
So there's the astounding kind of courage, yeah.
To see any animal being put through that suffering is always horrifying to me, matter what the purpose or what we might get out of it. Although I understand why they did it and how it was a product, and you know, but I don't look at it as a romantic time at all. I think anybody who knows anything about it would not be able to romanticize it.
Mm. Peggy, thanks very much. Eric?
Let me answer quickly. First, about the romance, I agree 100%. There were many accounts in the middle of the 1800s that talked about it as this romantic venture, a way to throw off the shackles of modern life, go whaling. But in truth, it was, as one whaleman said, a nasty, filthy humbug. It was a miserable way to earn a living, and it wasn't romantic at all. But to get to your point about the clips at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, yes, they still show them, and that was a silent movie down to the sea in ships. And to create some verisimilitude and to make it as realistic as possible, they hired an old whaling captain to take a converted schooner out of Gloucester, actually, the Gaspee, down off of, I think it was Bermuda, and they went sperm whale hunting, and they had cameras out in a whaleboat, and they had real whalemen, and actually the guy who was the star of the movie, who used to be was a submariner during World War I, on the way down was schooled in the art of throwing a harpoon, and he did it in the actual shots. So when you see that movie, Down to the Sea in Ships, and you see the whaling scenes, those are real.
Eric, remind us of the products that came out of whaling that could make it such a big part of the American economy. What right. was so valuable, all those parts you described?
Right. Well, it was mainly three things in this order. Whale oil and spermaceti oil from the sperm whale being the most valuable of all whale oils. Keep in mind that hundreds of years ago, we didn't have electric lights. And so the main form of illumination was whale oil. And it was used...
During what period? When did that become... I mean, presumably sometime it was just burning wood. But...
Oh, even in the medieval era, whale oil was sold in enormous quantities in Europe, and it was called Lumera.
Was that just for royalty, for the wealthy? No, was there enough
mainly,
to really...
Mainly for the wealthy, but then in the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s here and abroad, whale oil slowly filtered down not only just for the wealthy, but in the growing urban centers to keep them lit at night, to extend the day into night.
Why was it so preferred over, I don't know, pine knots or other kinds of oil?
Well, it didn't. Well, pine knots, for example, produced a huge amount of soot and smoke and pitch. Whale oil, especially sperm whale oil and fresh oil from other whales that wasn't, you know, too old, burned fairly cleanly and brightly, and it was at a reasonable price. So it was a better alternative, for example, than tallow candles. And then there were spermaceti candles made from the oil in the sperm whale's head, which were these exceptionally bright and clean-burning candles that were a big favorite of the rich and also Benjamin Franklin.
Now, let's say on the oil front, if you were to visit an American city, pick your city, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, right down to right. Charleston and Savannah in, I don't know, the late 1800s?
Late 1700s even.
Would every house have had its supply of whale oil for the evening lamps, or just a few? Or how
a lot of them. Certainly the more well-to-do would have. Mm-hmm. And at that time, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, there were parish lamps or lamps, street post lamps that would be lit using whale oil. It was very ubiquitous.
So we're talking
ubiquitous.
About a big volume business.
Oh, huge volume business. I mean,
all right, so there's just the oil. And then?
The oil... The oil was also used for lubrication. That's very important to keep the spinning, you know, the mills going and the gears of the Industrial Revolution mm-hmm. grinding. Mm-hmm. Whale oil was an excellent lubricant mm-hmm. before the era of petroleum. Mm-hmm. And then there was baleen, which came out of the mouths of baleen whales, like right whales and bowhead whales.
Mm-hmm. 10 foot, 14 foot long.
Absolutely. And you heat that up fibers. And you could mold it. And then when you cooled it down, it would retain its shape. So it was very useful for various fashion purposes. You can make the hoop in hoop skirts or the stays in corsets. And then finally, there was this mysterious substance called ambergris, which is the byproduct of irritation in a sperm whale's bowel as the squid beaks go down the digestive system.
Whales which eat tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of squid.
Squid. Have
those beaks irritate, it turns into a kind of special goop in its guts, and what is that?
Well, it's this black or brown waxy mass that could be the size of a baseball or could be a couple of 100 pounds in weight that they would oftentimes defecate. And what's amazing about ambergris, it attained its greatest value, and it was worth literally its weight in gold.
All the way back to Egyptian classic times.
Yeah, they used it burning as incense. The Italians put it in chocolate. I found a recipe from 1747 where it made a great icing for a cake.
And
I mean,
perfume in particular.
Perfume. The most important use was to prolong the scent of the perfume. And that begs a question. Who's the person that first decided that this waxy lump of material...
Let's dab on some whale poo here.
You could shave a little bit of it off and put it into perfume and make the smell last longer. I have no idea. But it's got this long, tortured history where for many centuries, natural philosophers would think about where did this come from? And there were different theories. Some thought it was dung from a tropical bird. Some thought it was sea foam.
You mean when they found it just floating?
They found it floating on the sea. They didn't know where it came from. Mm-hmm. They thought it was a mushroom that grew at the bottom of the ocean. And then finally, as more and more whalemen caught sperm whales and would dig into their intestines, intentionally cut into their intestines and find these large concretions
clumps
of waxy material, it was undeniable. That's where it came from, sperm whales. And sometimes you can make a poor voyage turn out well if you came upon some ambergris. There's the Watchman, a whale ship out of Nantucket in 1858 that came back after a little more than a year at sea with two casks full of ambergris, which it sold for $10,000. That's a lot of money.
So that's just for ambergris. You've got photographs here of docks on the west coast and east just covered in casks, big casks of oil. How big were the fortunes in the heyday? I mean,
many millions. I mean, Hetty Green, the Witch of Wall Street, inherited most of her fortune from the Howland family. She was part of the Howland family. And a lot of the wealthiest ship owners, when they saw petroleum, when petroleum was discovered in the late 1850s and sort of sank the whale oil market, a lot of them took their hefty fortunes and started investing in other industries, such as cotton, textile manufacture, and even petroleum fields.
And these were fortunes made young. Very often ships' captains were young men.
Yes, many of them were young men because it took a toll as you got older. But what happened is in the beginning of the era of whaling, sort of in the 1700s when whale ships were really going offshore, the gulf between what the captain and mates and the grunts or the crewmen earned was wide, but it wasn't gargantuan. But by the middle of the 1800s, the gulf between what the captains and mates earned and the green hands or the men before the mast was truly enormous.
A pittance if you were down at the bottom end of this food chain and a fortune at the top.
Yeah, many times after a four-year voyage, which was the average length during the height of the Golden Age, years at sea, you could come back if you were a man before the mast and have earned either nothing or even be in debt to the owners.
You'd better like the stories you brought over there. Because Will's calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My family played a small part in bringing some of this, the history of a voyage to light. My mother was rummaging through an old trunk in our attic and came across an old manuscript written by Thomas Nickerson, who was a whaler on the whale ship Essex, which was sunk by a whale in the Pacific Ocean. And I was wondering if your author had made use of any of that information.
Nickerson, a great name in this world, and the Essex sunk?
Right. Well, that, if I'm correct, tell me if I'm not, the manuscript that your mother found ultimately made its way to Nantucket and I think was used by Nat Philbrook to help craft his story in the Heart of the Sea. But I do not talk a lot about the ramming of the Essex because it was handled so well by Nat.
How often did that happen?
Not very often. I found two other instances where a male sperm whale intentionally rammed a fully loaded whale ship. And I talk about one of those, the Anne Alexander, which happened just about the time that Moby Dick was coming into print. And actually, Herman Melville wrote to a friend of his that his art, his fiction, had raised this very beast, and this was, in fact, the real Moby Dick. And an earlier caller talked about harpoons being embedded, I think, in the whale side for quite some time. Months later, after this whale sank the Anne Alexander, another whale ship killed a large bull sperm whale, and they knew that it was the one that had sunk the Anne Alexander because in its side were harpoons marked with the name of the ship that had sunk, and also there was wood embedded in the forehead of the whale from the hull of the ship.
Amazing, even at that size, that they could bring down not a whaling boat, not the light one, but the big mothership here.
A couple of hundred tons, 110-foot ship. Amazing.
Absolutely astounding. Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Just a totally fascinating conversation. Just totally fascinating conversation. And I'm glad you all talked about all the different uses of a whale. Mm-hmm. And I find it totally ironic that all those years ago, humans slaughtered almost millions of whales, you know, for oil. And now here we are, you know, in the 21st century, we're slaughtering humans over oil as well. And it seems like it's a terrible indictment on us as bad stewards of the planet, and we never learn our lesson. It seems like we continue to make the same mistakes over and over as human beings, and I'll listen off air. Thanks, guys.
Carl, we've got it. Eric, you're the whale man in the house. What do you say to that perspective?
Well, it's funny that he raises that issue because I've been told that an editorial that I wrote is soon going to appear in the Boston Globe, and I make a parallel between the whale oil industry and the petroleum industry, and how the whale oil industry, up until the very end when petroleum was discovered, they did not think that they were going to be knocked out by the competition, and then alternatives came to bear. And now with our petroleum age, there are alternative energies on the horizon, which may do the same thing. But as to a parallel between the way in which we're dealing with the petroleum era and the byproducts of that and the misery that's been caused as a result of various wars that are either in part or in total as a result of petroleum deposits, and comparing it to the days of whaling, I can't make a direct comparison to that, but I appreciate the caller's...
Well, and we see what Carl is saying. Humans will go to unbelievable extents to have the power of energy, whether it's from whale oil or some other kind. Let's go to one more caller, Dana, calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very quickly, I really think what your author is justifying, this is, you know, entrepreneurial capitalism, the American spirit. I think that's more of an implication of the commodification of these animals, and I really don't think putting it in a historical context justifies it any more than, you know, justifying Chicago gangsterism as well. It's part of their heritage.
Dana, let me ask you, do you think you would have poured whale oil into your lamp in 1820 if you had it to light up the night?
If I didn't know anything else, if I was completely ignorant of anything else, maybe, you know, I don't know what I'd be like in those days, but if there were alternatives, I certainly would have tried to use them. I'd like to believe I have the same ethic now that I would have the same ethic then that I have now.
We hear that, and our time is very short. Eric,
there's one implication in the caller's comment that I think is incorrect, and if he reads the book, he will see that. I do not justify what whalemen did. I simply lay out the historical context. I tell a story, an important story of America's history, and I think many of the reviewers have picked up on that point, that I don't sensationalize and I don't pass the judgment. I present the history as it was, because I think it's very dangerous to rewrite your history to comport with your current belief system. And just because we don't like a part of our history doesn't mean that it vanishes or that we shouldn't pay attention to it.
Herman Melville was fully attuned to the tension here. In Moby Dick, he has Ishmael musing about the Quaker, Captain Ahab. How now in the contemplative evening of his days the pious captain reconciled, you're saying, his Quaker beliefs with his actions as a whaleman. And Ishmael concludes, I do not know, but it did not seem to concern him much. And very probably he had long since come to the sage and sensible conclusion that a man's religion is one thing and this practical world quite another. This world pays dividends. There was certainly a sense of that
yes,
drive for the dividend right there on the high seas.
Money was at the root of it entirely.
Well, it is whatever one makes of it today, it is an amazing story, and you tell it vividly. We're grateful for the telling and for your time today. Eric J. Dolan's new book is Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America. Eric J. Dolan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I've sailed the wild ocean for decades or more, and oftentimes wondered what I do it for. I don't know the answer, it's
pleasure and pain. If I had my life over, I'd do it again. It's way over, way, sea over now. I'm as happy a man as the sea will allow. There's no other life for a sailor like me but to sail the salt sea, boys, sail the sea.